Actually, there are no fossil chimpanzees. There are no fossil gorillas. There are no fossil orangutans. At the same time, hundreds of species of apes that lived before versus the few species that we have today. But they're very weird as compared to the living apes, so no one agrees exactly what they mean. There is not even agreement whether they relate at all to any of the living apes, or they're just kind of some sort of experiments.
Those experiments might possibly have led to five of the most fascinating creatures on this planet, including one capable of walking upright with a big brain and extraordinary hands. Hi, I'm your host, Jerry Ellis, and on this episode of Talking Apes, we're talking about evolution. Ape evolution. Our evolution. I can think of few words that have been laced with as much misinformation and contempt as evolution. All of that, I think, has clouded our evolutionary vision, and questions about who I am and how did I get here remain. Fossils, fragments, footsteps in frozen stone all create more questions than they answer. On this episode, we're going to look at evolution by looking way back. We're traveling to a time in the Miocene, some 5 to 23 million years ago, before us and any of the other modern apes like us, chimps, gorillas, orangutans, and bonobos, even existed. My guest is Dr. Sergio Amesia, who has focused special attention on the processes leading to and following the split between humans and other apes. Sergio joins us from his home base at the American Museum of Natural History's Biological Anthropology Laboratory. It's from there that Sergio studies the evolution of humans alongside that of our other living ape relatives, including a focus on the evolution of hands, one of the most distinct traits of humankind. And if you think about it, our main source of interaction with our environment. And as Sergio will explain, apes like us share an extremely diverse lineage of primate ancestors. But it's these ancient Miocene primates that may hold the clues to how we became the upright big brain apes that we have become. And before we let Sergio go, we'll also tackle a few fundamental evolutionary questions highlighted in Sergio's new book, Humans, Perspectives on Our Evolution from World Experts. It's one of the most thought-provoking books that I've stumbled on in a very long time. So thanks for joining me on this episode of Talking Apes. You're listening to the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Talking Apes is made possible through the generous support of listeners like you and through our growing Patreon members program. For as little as $3 a month, we invite you to join those who have already committed to making this podcast a success. To support Talking Apes, start by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes, one word, .org. And now, my conversation with Sergio Amesia. Sergio, welcome to Talking Apes. I am so delighted you could share this time with us. This is wonderful.
I'm glad to be here, Jerry. Thanks for inviting me.
You look at apes in such a different way than anyone else we've ever had on the podcast. You look at ancient apes, but you also look at modern apes, including us, and sort of the bridges to those two types. And as I mentioned to people in the introduction, you know, your focus is on apes between 6 to 9 million years ago and back in the Miocene. So looking at these ancient apes.
Yes, I would say that that's kind of like the way I got started into all this ape business, right? Because I'm originally from a town near Barcelona in Spain, and you know, there's a lot of paleontological and archaeological sites, and actually there is that time period that you just mentioned, like, you know, 12 million years ago to 9 million years ago. It's critical to understand, like, the evolution of the group that includes apes and humans, and there are not many apes from that time period anywhere, even in Africa, but there are many in Europe, and actually have many sites with these kind of apes just basically in my backyard. And I was a student of biology, interested in evolution and human evolution, and I kind of got involved in all that research purely by just the circumstances. But then I kind of started, like, you know, connecting some of the dots. And basically, one of my big interests is kind of bridging the human evolution with ape evolution. Because if you think about it, apes, living apes, are not these kind of static entities that are just some sort of like living fossils, you know, that they never evolved. They are apes, and then humans change from something like a modern ape, like a chimpanzee. Really, like what the fossil apes that we're finding, apes that lived before humans and apes diverged from each other, like humans and chimpanzees have. There is estimates based on molecular clock analysis that we diverged from each other around 7 million years ago. So we have apes that lived before that time period. The show is that living apes have also changed. They have also evolved from other more primitive ape ancestors. So I kind of trying to understand ape evolution alongside human evolution. And that's important among many other things, because that's the only way that we can reconstruct or try to understand how the ape from which humans and chimpanzees evolve, which de facto is kind of the real starting point of human evolution and chimpanzee evolution. But you can go back and starting point of gorilla evolution, orangutan evolution, and so forth.
Well, that's what I find so fascinating, because I don't think most people, when we talk about evolution, and especially when we talk about the evolution of hominins and thinking about humans, that seems to be our focus all the time. You know, we don't talk about sort of this bigger picture of ape evolution. And I think most people think that apes are fairly static. Like a gorilla has always looked like a gorilla. An orangutan has always looked like an orangutan. And all the monkeys in the world look like what they look like. And that's what I think is so interesting about your work, is it opens up another window for most people in thinking about this evolutionary process, that prior to 6-7 million years ago, there was a whole lineage of these creatures on the planet that fall under what we collectively sort of think about as apes.
Correct. No, that's and I think it's kind of like a big unknown to the larger public. Of course, there are experts like me that work on that, but for the larger public, that's kind of like less known. And part of the reason is because it's so complex what was happening before, that even people in our field kind of try to not kind of think too much about it, kind of like look the other way and, well, we have all these fossils that we for sure know are somewhere in the human lineage in Africa or in other places later in time that clearly walk or they were walking bipedally on two legs, so they clearly are in our side. Let's try to understand like where they fit in our evolution without thinking, okay, but what they come from? What was happening before? You know, kind of the underlying assumption is, okay, let's compare humans, chimpanzees, and the fossils that we have of humans and see where they kind of fall in the spectrum between more chimp-like, more human-like, just assuming that the beginning is a chimpanzee, not giving the chance to the poor chimpanzees to evolve as well from something else that existed before.
Well, that was actually one of the questions I was going to ask you, but let's put that on pause for just a minute, and we're going to get to your book in for most of the conversation, a book called Humans, which is really fascinating. We're going to get to that for most of our conversation today. But I want to ask you the very first question that you ask in there, and that is of a number of other scientists, over 100 scientists. You ask, what was your beginning? So let's start with that with you. We've kind of touched on it a little bit, but yeah, tell us a little bit more about your beginning so people understand who you are and coming to this whole thing.
Yeah, okay. So I'm currently a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History studying human and ape evolution, but I'm originally from a little town near Barcelona in Spain. And basically what I said before, my story is that I was a student of biology, always interested in evolution in general, human evolution, had no idea exactly what to do. And then kind of I got involved in paleontological digs around the area where I live. Through that, I kind of discovered all these strange fossil apes that existed before even human evolution started. It went from just being like kind of like a hobby for me and for my summers to kind of try to understand like these fossils are remnants of like living and breathing apes that existed before in a particular ecosystem, and some of them could be key to understand the origins of modern apes and also humans. You know, basically that's how it started, no? Like I started digging more and more on them, figuring out that there was a lot of things that we still don't know. and like how all these fossils and their ecological context could inform the bigger picture, then some other discoveries like later on and the human on the human family, fossils of the human family that kind of seem to indicate that these that our lineage backs started like very, very early on at the end of the Miocene time. So before five and a half million years ago. And then it's when I start thinking, oh wow, it seems that, you know, like our lineage, the human lineage, originated at the time where these crazy, strange apes were around. So that's kind of what got everything like rolling for me.
One of the points that I saw in a online lecture that you did, you put up a map that showed where modern apes live. And then you show there were a series of little stars. There's probably, I don't know, 20, 30 little stars scattered around the planet. And, well, I should say scattered around everything but the Western Hemisphere, scattered around Asia and Africa and Europe. And so you just mentioned Spain. I don't think most people think about apes being in Spain. or many of the other places where these stars are kind of scattered around. And I think we have this concept that, you know, there's, I think it's called the East Side Story. It's this concept of this, the Rift Valley and everything kind of coming out of there, but it doesn't seem to really be the case.
I think it's not the case, but I guess there is not like a unanimity on that matter. It's actually a very heated debate among folks in my field about what happened, because as you mentioned, that the traditional story is the so-called East Side Story, which is based on it's a combination of where living apes live today plus which human fossils we had back in the 90s and before. And that's basically the story. Like I would just start by saying, like, I come to believe that humans are really like storytellers. And you know, this the game in which someone gives you three words and you have to come up with a story with those three words. We do everything like that. And then at the time we were just looking at living apes, and living apes seem to live in Africa along the tropical subtropical forest. And then we have apes, which are the chimpanzees and gorillas. And then we have in Asia, orangs and hylobates, the siamangs and gibbons, and also living in the same kind of environments in like very like dense forests, evergreen forests, tropical subtropical forests. And then at that time, we had fossils that were attributed to the early members of our family, like Australopithecus afarensis, living in East Africa, east of the Rift Valley, and some in South Africa. So it made sense to that you try to make sense. Those are the dots of information that we had at the time. Like, okay, reconstruct human evolution. 3, 2, 1, go. So, like, okay, so apes live in tropical forests. Humans are in these more like open environments today, more like kind of savannas in East Africa and South Africa. And that's where we had the fossils. So what happened? Okay, so probably the Rift Valley was kind of some sort of barrier, geographical barrier. And then some apes kind of left the forest into this more open savanna environment, and it was more useful for them and for survival to kind of become bipeds because there are not so many trees to climb and move around, and that kind of freed our hands from locomotion, so we could use them to manipulate tools better. And eventually it was some sort of feedback. This comes right from Darwin times, right? Like 150 years ago, like that created some sort of feedback loop, like bigger heads that allow us to manipulate things better, better hands to manipulate things better, you know, the advent of advanced culture and tools and so on and so forth, leading to eventually to modern civilization. But as you mentioned, if you actually look at the fossil record, not just of human fossils, but fossil hominoids, which include all the apes and human fossils, then things get more and more and more complicated, because you find there are sites with those fossils predating the split of humans and apes, chimpanzees, like in other parts of Africa, like in the Central Africa and the Chad, like in Western Southern Africa and Namibia, all over Europe, all over the Middle East, all over Asia. And many places that today are nothing to do with tropical rainforests. And even back at the time, in that time, like paleoecological reconstructions based on isotopes or fauna, which animals live there, it seems that they were never tropical rainforests either. So they were like kind of forest areas, but not, probably many of them were evergreen forests. So there were fruits all year round, but they were not like this close, dense packed tropical to tropical rainforest. And even some apes are being found in places that are reconstructed as being already savannas. So kind of basically things get increasingly more complicated when you bring all these apes, these fossil apes to the picture. And to make things worse, the same way that we have many fossils in Africa and other parts where the early human fossils are all in Africa, everyone agrees that they are somewhere in the human lineage because they have features that only humans have, such as principally being a biped. Features are along the skeleton indicating that they were walking bipedally, even though some other features don't look so human, they look some kind of ape-like. We don't have the same consensus with the living apes. There are no fossil chimpanzees. There are no fossil gorillas. There are no fossil orangutans. At the same time, we have 40 plus genera, hundreds of species of apes that lived before versus the few species that we have today. But they are very weird as compared to the living apes. So no one agrees exactly what they mean. There is not even agreement whether they relate at all to any of the living apes or they're just kind of some sort of experiments, because they are so different and then they live in different parts of the world. So that's still happening. That debate is to kind of settle what's happening here before human and apes like diverge. It's still happening. And that's why like many researchers who study and promote and talk and write about human evolution to the public tend kind of, okay, this is too complicated. Let's just like focus on the fossils that we know are somewhere in our site.
So basically, we start about 6 million years ago, and then we just move forward.
Exactly.
And don't bother with others. Well, it seems like there's a few other challenges there. I mean, first of all, most of the modern apes, as you said, live in tropical forests. Those tend to not be, at this point, they don't tend to be good places to find fossils. So if that was consistent 15 million years ago, we are going to be struggling to find fossils.
No, you got it right. That's a big problem we have today. Like, if really the ancestors of chimpanzees lived where modern chimpanzees live, the same for gorillas, the same for orangutans, then probably we may never even find fossils there. Because the living, all these animals, when they die, it's actually very hard to find their skeletons. They quickly degrade and disappear. So how likely is that we're going to find, if they were living in that environment at the time, how likely is that we're going to find any fossil of those bones, like millions of years later? So that's a big challenge. You know, like we're putting together hypotheses and stories of what happened based on what we have. And what we have might be very limited by just the nature of the whole ecosystems work. Just they might not, those fossils, those remnants of those fossil species, those extinct species, we might never find them. Or maybe if we were lucky enough, we were lucky enough that some of these fossils are actually fossilized somewhere and we eventually will find them, but maybe covered today by forest. So in any case, even if they fossilize, it's going to be very hard to like find them. But I think I'm hopeful, honestly. I think, I tell everyone that the same, like many of the most, actually, I think the majority of fossils that are found today in Europe are accidents. Someone is building a road. Someone is like digging to build a parking garage. And that's where we find everything, from a Roman cemetery to a dinosaur and everything in between. But this is not, you know, it's kind of not so, this is not happening so much in Africa, for example. But who knows what's happening in the future? And we know that now in Africa, for better or worse, there are like big like roadways being built these days, right? So we'll see.
Then is it we have to turn to things like you do with looking at specific functions, motion, and how we move, for example? Like you've spent a chunk of your career looking at the evolution of the hand.
So I think that's where some of the fossil apes that we're finding today that look weird and might be or might not be related to any of the living apes today, they can still, I think, fill some of the gaps in our knowledge. And one example is a fossil great ape that was discovered like in the early 2000s, originally published in Science 2004. Actually, we published a couple of weeks ago an article with a 3D reconstruction of its face, but it's a partial skeleton which has key parts of the body that help us figure out how the whole animal was. It's called Pyrrolophithecus, and it's about 12 million years ago, found during the expansion of an old rubbish dam. And again, another accident, a lucky accident for my team. And what's interesting is that the combination of features that it shows, it's something that we don't have among the living apes, and shows another alternative, not just a whole an ape or a great ape in this case, because it was a large body, has some features of all of the three living great apes today, orangs, gorillas, chimpanzees, without being like any one of them exactly. And it shows something that we don't have today. A different way of being a great ape, and another possibility of how an ancestor of living apes and humans could look like. And to go, you want some more detail on that and related to the hand question you were asking, most, but not all the living apes, because gorillas are their own kind of thing that I'm just going to leave to the side for now, and have features that are very similar. From a distance, they all have features that are related to having, together with humans, we all have what is called this orthograde body plan, meaning an upright body plan, which is different from the pronograde or the primitive body plan that, you know, monkeys have, which is most similar to like a cat or a dog, in which they have like a narrower torso, the limbs are on the sides, they're basically built to walk on their four legs. Whereas living apes and humans, we all have this upright body posture. It's basically forced by the way we're built. Our torso is like kind of like shallow, wider, our shoulder blades are on the back. And, you know, modern apes, not us, have long limbs relative to short hind limbs. The ones that are very good on the trees, climbing and hanging below the branches, have very long chord digits. So we only look at the living apes. We could assume that, okay, those are all features that they all share because they evolved from an ancestor that already was like that. It has this upright body posture and long forelimbs, long chord digits to hang below the branches. So therefore, the ancestor was like that, and probably we humans evolved from something like that. Now, we bring fossils like Pyrrolophithecus, and it shows a combination that we don't have today, which is like part of the clavicle, the ribs, the pelvis, some vertebra. It seems that that orthograde upright body plan was already there 2 million years ago. But then we have both hands, and we can combine bones from both hands to have a very complete hand. And it turns out that it's not like any of the living apes. It's more like a large monkey. It's like shorter digits, less curve, longer thumbs. And that's like kind of, if we have to choose, they're not like modern humans, but if we have to decide what's closer to Pyrrolophithecus, humans are closer to Pyrrolophithecus 2 million years ago than to any of the living apes that hang below the branches of the trees. So that opens other possibilities. Like, oh, wow. So it seems that in the fossil, and then we don't have any fossil ape until later, millions of years later, that have already these long curved fingers, adaptations that we see to be good hanging below the branches of the trees. So it seems that features that relate to having an upright body posture evolve before features that are adaptations to hang below the branches of the trees. Doesn't mean they could not hang below the branches of the trees, but it means that did not have the body adaptations to do it very well like living apes do. So what does it mean? Like, is it possible, because the old stories that we humans evolved from an ancestor that probably was hanging below the branches of the trees, and that's why we had this upright body posture that subsequently was used to walk on two legs. But now it seems that if we look at these fossil apes, that maybe the upright body posture evolved before adaptations for hanging below the branches of the trees. So is it possible that the same way that living apes evolve later on adaptations to hang below the branches of the trees before having this upright body posture? Is it possible that the ancestors of humans evolved to be bipeds from an ancestor like that without having to ever hang below the branches of the trees like living apes do? Those are ideas or possibilities that we could not even like consider if we didn't have this like time shot from the past that fossils bring to us.
Yeah, no, that kind of flips it on its head when you start thinking about evolution. No. in that sense. I mean the whole idea, in watching a short video you shared showing the evolution of the hand and the fact that an orangutan hand is actually perhaps more evolved than our hands,
For some features, for some purposes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. I think it makes us think about who we are and how we got here in a whole different way.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the things we could go on all day about this, and we'll do another podcast with you and dig deeper into this. But I know you're under a time crunch, and I want to make sure we turn to your book. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute with Sergio to talk about his new book, Humans: Perspectives on Our Evolution from World Experts. First, I'd like to invite in assistant producer Demelza Bond for a quick catch-up on all things Talking Apes behind the scenes. Hi, Demelza.
Hello, everyone. Hope you're all doing good out there. So I've been talking to some of our listeners over the last couple of weeks, and I've been asking people to tell us a story about their experience with primates. Elsie Shulman wrote in and she said, "Hello, I just love all primates. As a former resident of Florida, I've had the privilege of visiting Save the Chimps. It was a wonderful experience. I've heard amazing things about that place. I wish it was a little bit closer to me, but I'm all the way in Europe. But thank you very much for that, Elsie." Rick Wood wrote in, he said, "I've been doing observational data collection as a citizen scientist on a group of long-tailed macaques that live in urban Jakarta. Mostly, I've been tracking human interactions and its relationship to foraging of natural food sources. So I asked Rick about his findings in this project and if it shocked him. And he said, yes, most definitely. I've always understood that habituation was the underlying cause of conflict. However, after 2 years with the same troop, data points significantly to human fear or misunderstanding of nonverbal cues as the main driver of aggressive incidents. The presence of human foods exacerbates any human interactions with monkeys, but it isn't the central cause of conflict." Thank you so much for that, Rick. That's really, really fascinating. And if anyone else has got any similar stories where you're working with primates or you're studying primates and you found something interesting, please do write in. Just one more. Somebody who goes by Feral Fawn wrote in and she said, "After a particularly adorable interaction with an adolescent orangutan at Toledo Zoo, through the glass at Toledo Zoo, I decided to change my major from nursing to zoology." Oh, we love to hear it. We love people going down that path. We've got a nurse turned primate protector on our team, actually, here at Clobio. So shout out to the gorgeous Megan. Please keep sending us your primate stories in, folks. We so enjoy them. Or maybe you just want to come and say hello or tell us what you think of the podcast. Give us a suggestion for a guest. If you want to talk to us, go to talkingapes.org and click contact us. Or you can send a message or leave a comment by social media. We're on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, all the big ones. Whilst you're over on our website, don't forget to click on the merch button and check out our lovely range of hoodies and t-shirts. We've got some new designs up this week. All profits from merch sales go towards the production of this podcast. You can also support us by making a donation or a small monthly contribution through Patreon. All details are on our website at talkingapes.org. Thanks for listening. Now back to Jerry.
Thanks, Demelza. And now back to my conversation with Sergio Amesia. I have a couple of questions I want to get us started on the book. One is why you wrote the book, but also why you chose the format that you chose. Because as somebody who's written a handful of books, it's a really fascinating format. And so maybe you can describe both why you went about it, but also why you chose the format you chose.
The book Humans was basically a life experiment that I did. You know, it just kind of came out like that in my head. I was teaching at the time human evolution in a university. I always struggle to tell a simple story. And that's what people want to hear, a simple story. And the more I know is like, you know, every different stages of knowledge, the more you know how much you don't know. And now I was so lost at some point of I don't want to just tell a simple story to these young students. I want to showcase them that everyone has an opinion and everyone sees the same data with different eyes and reach different conclusions. And, you know, so it went from me trying to, if I had to write my own book of human evolution that would help me teach and others learn, like trying to summarize everything we know, to like, why should I try to summarize what hundreds of others have done and think about when I could just maybe just like talk to these people and ask them to explain in their own words what they work on, why they think it's important. And that's kind of how the idea of the book came out, because basically the book is, I don't tell people I wrote the book. I guess I would say I made the book happen. You know, I guess it would be like you're the director of a movie or something like that, or a filmmaker, that you enlist a huge team of people to bring something big together. And that's basically the book. It's like over 100 world experts in different fields of generally related to human evolution. There's a lot of paleontologists, but there are also archaeologists, people who study human behavior, primate behavior, people who do genetics, people who do psychology. And they are like from all kinds of backgrounds and ages from different parts of the world. I have to say that many of the researchers on the book are like more senior, on the senior side, because that was just my personal interest. Like I happen to know many of them personally. They've been for a long time heroes of mine. I used to read all their papers back in the day in the library as a student. I eventually met many of them in person. I have even worked with some of them. And I was like amazed by how many new students don't even know about these people, because one of the participants in the book, which is in his late 70s now, basically was telling me like, I don't think many students are going to know who any of the people in your book is, because, you know, my experience is that no one even is aware about the existence of anyone who lived more than 20 years before their time and was working, you know, and that before 20 years. And I'm like, well, then let's make this happen. I don't care. Like, everyone is going to know about all of you. And they're like more younger researchers, but I started with the more senior because of that. And then basically I'm kind of like a informal kind of guy. And I wanted to like show, because I knew personally many of these people, that behind the big papers, behind the big names, many of these people are like, just, they're humans like anyone else. And I just wanted to, on the one hand, showcase them and their work, but also their stories. So that's why I came out with a list of questions and send them all the same questions, some of them via email, others in person, whatever was necessary. Yeah, I was just really interested in gathering their feedback. Some questions are more philosophical, others about their backgrounds, others about more what their work, others about what they think all means when you look at everything together. And to do that, I phrase the questions in a more kind of less traditional way that in many other more technical textbooks. But in the end, I think they get to the core of what's important.
And that's what I find so fascinating about the book. You don't, as you say in the introduction, describing yourself as a director, like on a movie set, is a great way to talk about this. It's this series of responses to the questions. And sometimes they're short answers, sometimes they're very long answers. It's not a novel. There's not a beginning, middle, and end. You can pick it up and thumb through, which I have been doing night after night, just reading a couple of them. And each one of them for me has seemed to open a new window to thinking about the world we live in, and not always specifically evolution by any means. So what I wanted to do, I don't know if anybody's done this with you before, but what I would like to do is I'd like to go through the 10 questions with you, and I'd like to have you answer those 10 questions that you asked everyone else, because people can pick up your book, and I will have a link to it in the blog that accompanies the podcast, to buy the book. And it's really an amazing book. You don't have to be a scientist to read this, and they can read what everybody else wrote. I'm fascinated how you would answer each of these 10 questions. So can we do that?
Okay, let's do it. Now, you put me in a spot, because it's a reason why my answers are not in the book. But, you know, I wanted to know what the others think, you know, and I think I'm cheating now a little, because it's a kind of after the fact, I know so many perspectives that I didn't have before. It opened many windows also in my head. And I think I can come up with my own you know, but okay, let's do it. Let's see
that would have been actually, that would be a really fascinating exercise if you would have answered the 10 questions, written them down, put them aside.
And before then, and after.
And then done this afterwards. But we'll go with the after to start with that. The first one was your beginnings, and you've kind of filled us in on that. That's your personal beginnings. So I'll jump to the second question, which is game changer. Can you, with each of these questions, can you tell us what you were after when you asked that question, and then what it is for you?
Okay, so game changer to me, I wrote this question thinking about, is there anything from a paper that you read, from a discovery that happened, to an event in your life, is there anything that really like flip the way you look into things that affected the way, that basically affect the way you work? Basically this was a very interesting outcome of that is that now is a section at the end of the book called basically recommended readings that really is a compilation of all the papers and books that people recommended as game-changing for them, game-changing events or works for them. So I just recommend, I think it's a good resource because it's really pointed, many of them point to similar, to the same books and papers, but some people kind of bring out kind of more obscure works that really like change everything for them and then probably might help many others, people who are actually in the field and want to know more about certain topics, right? But so that was the idea, and to me, I can think clearly about game changing for me. It was like, it's not that I started doing field work and finding fossils, getting involved in research. I was doing that. I was never thinking it was going to be my career. I was like a biology student, no idea what I was going to do for sure. I just love nature, and I got involved in field work as a summer hobby. And then later on in museum work and all that, just a hobby. No, just my hobby. But I remember distinctively doing field work 2002 in the summer in the south of Spain, in an early Pleistocene site. And it came out in the all over the world in all the news that they, like a French team, have discovered this fossil in North Central Africa in Chad, which is called Sahelanthropus chadensis. The 7 million year old like cranium that it was described as the earliest member of the human lineage. And it just kind of like blew my mind, you know, just thinking that, because at the time is when all these fossils from humans were found in East Africa and South Africa. And the earliest have like 3 to 4 million years. And all of a sudden you're telling me that they are like members of the human lineage living like in North Central Africa 7 million years ago. It kind of changed everything for me. So that relation, in relation also with all these other fossil sites around where I live that were apes that lived before human and apes split. So before the 7 million years ago, actually, I was kind of like, boom, everything collapsed together for me, you know? And I kind of like got into this spiral of like digging and digging and digging and digging. And here I am today. That's quite still, I'm still doing that 20 years later.
Yeah, that would be a game changer, I guess. Indeed. The next question is amazing fact.
So just to save space in the book, we summarize every question with just one or two words. But really, like in anyone who reads the book, there's a whole question at the beginning of the book. I kind of explain the intention of each question and how the whole question actually in this case was, what fact about humans or human evolutions human evolution amazes you the most, right? And then the short was amazing fact. And with that, I was just like, you know, this first question was kind of like, as you mentioned there, not everyone answered all the questions, but that's okay because in instructions, when I send the questions around, I told everyone, you don't have to answer all the questions. Just choose the ones that you want to answer and that's okay. And then what happened, just this is a little interlude, I know, but I think it's important. It's what happened is that it opened the door for many people to answer questions and just avoid the ones that they were kind of more, they were struggling more with. Because like many of the participants in the book told me that they seem simple questions, but they really like made them sit down for days or weeks or months, sometimes months, pondering about everything, you know, putting everything together, you know, and And one of my, the people that I, is one of my, she's one of my, my heroes is in the book. It's a professor from Stony Brook. And she even like sent an email to me saying like, I just find these questions too daunting. You know, and I was like, well, just answer the ones that you want, you know, so it really helped. And one thing that also happened, and I was, it was, that was also no accident. I tell them, answer in your own words. There's, you can answer with one word, one sentence, one paragraph, one page. No more, please, because, you know, we have a limit here. But that basically do whatever comes to mind, you know. And what happened is that many other experts in the book know each other, and they are telling me that, wow, the way this person answers with this one sentence, sharp, is clearly his, her personality is reflected in the answers. Other people have like 2-page long answers. And you talk to that guy in a bar, you are drunk before the end of the conversation, right? So what happened is that really these questions reflect very well the personalities of the people. It's kind of, you are having like a bar conversation with them. And I really, that was kind of designed to be that way. And I like the output. But amazing fact is one of these first introductory questions is just kind of icebreakers, right? And just something came out of what they found curious about the whole thing. You know, it's anything that they find curious, you know? And I guess in my case, I guess one thing I find fascinating of the whole thing is that studying humans as an organism, as a species, in comparison to apes and other species on the planet and the environments in which they evolve and they live today, I think it amazes me like how like tightly related we are to everything else, but at the same time we humans feel so isolated, not just as a species from all the other species on the planet. We kind of feel isolated as individuals. We think that the skin is kind of, our skin is kind of the border between our persona and the world, you know? And really like, I think that the more I study biology and evolution, it seems that that's not the case. Like we are ecosystems within ecosystems from cellular level and below, to the planet and beyond, you know, and it's kind of more our cultural like constructs around things that really makes us think that we are kind of separated, but what we are not. And that really is something I'm still kind of digging into that these days, finding very, very fascinating.
Yeah, no, I love that idea as ecosystems within ecosystems. I think that makes you think a lot differently about a human being if you think that way, rather than
I think we are. I think that it's we are made literally of everything that comes in and out every day, from what we breathe to what we eat. You know, like, so it's like there is no border here. Even this in the skin is like exchanging constantly. So it's like a fantasy that we are like some kind of like discrete entity. You know. And I don't know. I wonder. I don't know, because I like to be in the mind of another, of a neighbor, another animal, to see how things look like. Just from the sensory, the whole sensory system is so different that probably everything looks and feels completely different. But is that really a sense of separation, or probably not? I don't know.
That's interesting, because that's the same. I mean, he's written several books on it, but we had on the podcast Carl Safina, and he, and talking about, you know, If we're truly to understand how we exist on this planet and have some empathy for the other creatures on this planet, we have to somehow get in their skin, I guess, to use your analogy. You know, we'd have to get in their skin and look out through their eyes and think about the world as they think about it. But then you have a set of core questions.
To me, the core question, I guess I call it core questions because it's kind of the meat. It's like, okay, now presentations are over. You know, we know about you, your interests, how you got here. Now, this is what I really want to ask you, you know?
Ah, okay. So, time travel. What?
Time travel.
Okay, so. Sergio, time travel. What is it?
So, the question of time travel was like, if you had a one round trip ticket to anywhere in time, where would you go? Where, when would you go, and why? And that's basically a fun, I guess, more intriguing way to ask what is important for you? Why? What are you working on? Why is it so important? Because what happens is that people who, for example, study Australopithecus afarensis, like early bipeds, the ones that were really more like a human in the way they move around than previous species, they would say, oh, these are real examples from the book. Oh, I would totally go to Ethiopia or Tanzania 3 million years ago to see Homo Australopithecus afarensis was walking around, because there are so many. I study like primate locomotion, human locomotion, and we have all these big debates about whether they were walking already like us or some sort of weird bipedal locomotion that was not exactly human, not like a chimpanzee walks, something different. And it's all this big debate about how the length of the femur relates to the lever arm of that muscle. So I would really love to be there and like video shoot this animal moving around and like solve the issue, you know? So it's a way, it's a door to a bigger, real, current research problem or question, you know? That was the intention. And then if I have to answer that question, I have to say that, you know, I think some time ago I would answer something like, I would go to the past for sure. Like I don't know exactly when, but probably when around the time when the humans and apes diverged from each other, how were these apes from which the human lineage originated? How they look like, how they were moving already at the time. Where was the environment they were? What were they eating? What happened? They got lost outside the forest and they end up in a different environment and they had just to survive doing weird things such as walking on their two legs all day long. What happened? So that was like what I would answer some time ago. But now I'm surprised myself that I think now I would like to go to the future. And not sure where. Like I think probably not too long far in the future that everything is so different that I cannot make sense of anything. But maybe sometime in the future, which I'm not sure when this will or if it will happen, in which humans talk about humans as something from the past.
Wow.
You know,
that's not the answer I thought you were going to give. The first answer was closer to what I thought you were going to say. But that is interesting, because some people in the book did mention going to the future. The idea that humans in the future would look back at us the way we look back at the fossil us.
Yeah, I think that's to me, like, what was like?
Yeah.
How are they, how they think about us now? You know, as something, this species from the past that, you know, are they going to look at us like this one weird thing that happened before? Or, I don't know, like, I'd like to know. I like to be around that time when things start to switch.
Because you often, you know, it's interesting because you hear, because now we have devices, which we use our thumbs in a much more aggressive way than we ever have in the past, with all of the handheld devices and things like that. And, you know, some people have said, you know, that the other digits might just fade away. It would be interesting if, like, yeah, some far place in the future, people were mostly kind of thumbs in a single digit and they just operated little spatial devices or something, and people would look back and go, when did that happen that we lost that precision grip of, you know, the whole hand? And yeah, no, that's a really interesting. Okay, moving on before we run out of time. The next question, driving factors.
So the full question here was about basically like what happened that basically made like a straight jumpstart the human evolution? Why a set of apes like went into a different evolutionary space so different from the others that we have humans alive today, right? And that, like, many people in the book answer that there's no way to know this. but I know, I think I clearly don't have all the answers. Obviously, this is one of my main research topics, like understanding the human chimpanzee divergence. I think at the end of the day is about climate change, like the changing climate, changing the environment. And it's not an accident that not just humans diverge from chimpanzees. It's no accident that all these hundreds of species of apes disappear. Something really big happened. And now we have a bunch of apes and us, but we're just kind of like what's left of a huge radiation of apes that were there before. So what happened, I'm not sure, but I think it relates to, we know there like, it was like, the environment was changing over during the late Miocene a lot, and some of these more continuous forests that kind of occupy larger portions of Africa, Middle East, Asia, and Europe, where the apes, fossil apes are found today, like all these forests disappear, and with them all the animals that were adapted to live in those forests. So I think something like that relates to like a bunch of weird apes going into a new territory, and here we are today. But the details, I think no one knows the details.
Huh. We're going to run out of time, so I'm going to skip the future evolution because you kind of, you hinted at it a little bit.
Yeah.
But evolutionary lessons. I'm really curious about somebody who spent their life looking at evolution.
So basically, to me, this was a very important question, because sometimes I find myself like thinking like, wow, like I just spent the last 4 years of my life writing these papers. You know, like, does it mean anything? Is it important for anything? Or is it just like a entertaining way to spend my time, you know? Like, maybe four people in the world that care about the same stuff that me is going to read the paper, like, you know, really like, in-depth way, right? Certainly my parents, I would never read this paper, you know, they're going to find it so boring. So kind of, I was just like, is this all work useful? Is this, it has some kind of like, is it important or not? Or just something fun to do, to work on? You know, it's like a big problem that we want to, as humans, like to know everything, right? So kind of, I brought that question to all these experts to gather their feedback. And actually, I was surprised that many of them answered what I just said. Like, I don't think it is useful at all, but it's so fun, you know? And knowledge for knowledge is great. Why you need to justify it? Things like that, which is fine. I don't have anything against that. But many other people actually brought up very interesting perspectives that, oh, this is really important. Some of them had practicalities. I can't remember. I think one that stood in my mind is the answer by a professor from Kyoto, Yutaka Kunimatsu, who actually, he's a guy.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
Tell me, what's happened?
It did the same for me. I'm curious what you're going to say, because I was going to ask you specifically about him.
Oh, that's great.
So you go ahead first.
So to me, it was fascinating. On the one hand, it's a guy that studies these weird fossil apes like me. That he works in different sites in Kenya. So I was kind of even like, and then he brings up that he teaches human evolution at the university there. And like one of the things that he starts the course with is basically telling the students that one thing that he wants them to gather from the course is thinking bigger chunks of time, not just thinking on time as days, weeks, months, years, their life span, but like in larger time scales, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years. And then he thought that was useful is that he provided a very real example. Is like the disaster of the nuclear plant Fukushima in 2011 followed, like, was a big earthquake, giant tsunami, like, and it was basically like affected the power plant, the nuclear power plant, causing this great accident, right? But part of the problem could have been like diminished to a big extent if the backup electrical generators for the power station had been situated in higher ground, because they would not have been affected by the tsunami. And actually, since that many researchers informed during the construction of that power plant back in the day, they informed both the government and the company who built it and ran it, that there were historical accounts, just looking at the geology, that giant tsunamis have hit that area in the past. So they suggested to have these backup power generators in higher grounds in case something like that would ever happen again. All those comments were ignored. So both the plant and the backup generators were affected by the tsunami. So things could have been much less worse if we had, if people have had these just ingrained in their minds that to think in broader time scales. And that's something that's studying evolution, because evolution is very hard to, there are some experiments of how evolution works in like life, but it's very, very limited. Most of what we know about evolution happens in a time scale that is millions of years. So it's hard to just think of millions of years, but it might be actually useful and essential for survival, actually.
Yeah, that's exactly where I went, because I think, you know, in thinking about just the hominins alone, and we're looking at, you know, between now and 25 million or something years ago, we're always talking in millions of years. And I think it's really hard for people to put that into some kind of context. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I remember one of the people we were talking to on the podcast, they were talking about 2.5 million years ago, but then down at 1.8 million years ago. Well, wait a second, time out. That's 700. I mean, that's, you're talking about close to a million years. We can't even, I mean, we have only been sort of who we are for the last 12,000 years. I mean, it's just like a time frame that we don't think. But that's what that example put into context, that we do need to think about our actions over a longer period of time. And that was one of those things I read, and I just went, my mind kind of went boom. I just thought, yeah, there is a very practical everyday reason that we can't think about these pathetic 60, 70 year lifespans that we have. You know, the world.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
It is. I can tell you that just when I started working on this book and sending questions, I started with a little group of people that I know personally, and kind of like, look, I'm doing this experiment. Would you like to answer these questions? And I kind of like, they were looking at me weird. Like, this guy is completely lost it, you know? And shouldn't you be studying fossils? What are you doing? You know? But actually, like, when some of the answers start to come my way and I start compiling them for the book, I started doing all this without any book deal or having talked to any publisher or anything. It's now published in Columbia University Press, which is, I think, kind of the best like textbook publisher ever, you know? But like, at the time I was just thinking, what the hell am I going to do with this? You know, and I have all these people now and they have these great insights and I have to make something with it, you know, but I kind of started as my personal experiment. But as soon as I started to gather some of these answers and answers like that, I was like, okay, this needs to happen. This book absolutely needs to happen. I want this out, and let's see how it goes.
Indeed. So did you answer that question?
The lessons. Well, I think that myself, my answer is like, I had struggled before about whether or not this is something that has a direct usefulness. And after reading some answers such as this one from Kunimatsu, basically this thing of just bringing large time scale into the big picture of my daily existence, I think it's really important, really helped me put things into perspective. And that would be my answer today. That it's, but you know, there are other examples that, you know, like, again, this is kind of, I'm answering with hindsight, so it's kind of, I'm cheating, but other researchers have also pointed out in this book, like, all the lessons that we have developed about how to treat some sicknesses that modern humans have today, like obesity, for example, and how it is related to the way in which we have evolved. You know, we evolved to store sugar and fat because it was a very rare thing in our diet. But now in our current like Western society ecosystem, sugar and fat is like unavoidable in anything you eat. But our bodies are still lagging in adapting to that. So we don't have an adaptations to deal with. We are adapted to actually gather as much as we can in our system, because it's a rare thing to find in the ecosystem. You know, so that, you know, that kind of answers, like, yeah, I think there are evolutionary lessons to be learned and to be implemented in our lives, from the way we build things, in the places we build things, the kind of diet that we do, and so on and so forth. So my answer is yes, there are evolutionary lessons, and those are some examples.
Special. Are humans special?
So this is kind of the last tail end of the questions, which was more like more philosophical questions. And that was, this question was just like, know, out of curiosity, but also to kind of like raise some, spark some itch in the experts, because you know that we have basically it's like a bimodal distribution here with the answers. This like some people are like, we're not special. We're not more special than any other species in the world. By definition, every species is a special. That's why they are a species, right? But on the other hand, other people are like, of course humans are special. Other animals don't write books. They don't ask other animals about what's going to happen to them a million years from now. We are special. That's, you know, another people. There are actually some people breaching both and being like, well, we, every species is special. Humans are uniquely special, you know. My answer would be that kind of along that middle, you know, like we are special, but every species is special about a different thing. And like, which aspects are humans special? I guess that would be a better way to rephrase this. And in that sense, I think that obviously like other animals don't do things that we do. And a lot has to do with our language, human language, which is something that is kind of, I starting to see language as something more important than I used to before, especially after some of the answers in the book, because it kind of, it's, I see it as a, really the software of our minds, of our brains. It's just the way our brains work with language. It's a way to communicate with ourselves, like the voice in your head, you know, and the way we talk to others. And I think that makes, you know, like that's how we build our personalities, our egos, which is some sort of, honestly, like now in the age of artificial intelligence, that's to me an artificial intelligence. That's not a natural intelligence. Every organism has natural intelligence, but we, on top of our natural intelligence, which to me is the way our body works, we don't have to think, I have to breathe. We don't have to think, oh, my stomach has to start digesting this at this rate, or my gut has to do this other thing, or I have to start perspirating. We don't think any of these things. This is intelligence. The body is intelligent. They are like all these cells talking to each other, like, you know, regulating like each other, so giving feedback to each other. They are intelligent. This has nothing to do with our language. But on top of that, we have this extra layer of artificial intelligence, in which we have thoughts and we have some degree of freedom of what we can do and not do with that. And in that sense, I guess that's we're special for that. And I think it's something other people have referred to as like the reality for humans is more like a augmented reality. You know, like a dog or a cat looks at a tree and sees, we don't know what they see, but probably they see a tree. But we see a tree and we think about things that remind us of a tree. Memories of when we were children were climbing trees, and about, you know, like we have this extra layer, you know, that relates to just language and our culture. So I guess that's what makes us special, but doesn't mean that other creatures are not special just in their own special way.
Wow. No, I actually love that answer. We're really getting close. I know you have to run, and so I hesitate to ask this next question because I think it might have – it's the next question is religion and spirituality. And okay.
We can do it fast. I can do like a summary of what happened in the book and don't go into details. Because okay, this could be a whole podcast, I think.
It could, because some people wrote quite a bit about the subject. And especially when you ask scientists this, you know, people who we typically think are on one side of the fence when it comes to this issue, and that's not the case in many of the answers. Let's jump to advice. And we'll let people pick up the book and read the spirituality religion.
Yeah, exactly.
Piece.
They can. Yeah, I can just give a succinct summary, which is that it was a big surprise for me the feedback I got about that question, because it was basically the question: is it compatible to have religious or spiritual views of the world with studying evolution, human evolution, so on and so forth? So I was like kind of hesitant to ask this question. But actually, I'm so glad I did it, because the answers were like very illuminating from all ends. everything, all views are represented here from not compatible whatsoever because ABCD, blah, blah, blah. They are completely compatible because ABC and everything in between. And one thing I would highlight here is that it's kind of a very clear trend among people in the US and outside the US. And you can guess what the trend is. But it could be another podcast exactly about it. I'm very proud and glad that I asked the question because it was a very positive surprise for me, like all the feedback that I got. Then the next question was advice. Basically, it was meant. So this is considered by many like a question that's going to be very useful for students of human evolution in general or evolution. But actually, I think it's going to be, I ask it with the intention that could be useful for anyone, even if they don't work in human evolution or evolution, because the question is like, if you are interested in any of these topics, like what advice, you as an expert in this thing, would you give to anyone interested in any of these topics? And basically, you know, like people would like give their own advice of what helped me, you know, to get motivated to work on these or like be successful at these or, you know, and there's all kinds of feedback from like never give up to like, you know, like just follow your passion to don't follow your passion, just like figure out some little niche in this like system in which you can provide something useful so you will get a job or do it but have a backup job. Everything is there, right? To me, if you ask me this question, what advice would I give to anyone interested in that? I would be, no matter, if you're interested on it, please don't just read the news. Because there are some good reporters out there, but I don't think there are the majority of them. I think everyone wants to have a flashy title and this changes everything somewhere in the text. And I would suggest not only read the news, then read the actual papers, the actual books, and read them in detail and try to actually understand what they're asking, what they are doing, how they are doing it. Does it make sense what they're doing with the actual question they were asking? Is the result that they got actually had anything to do with the question that they were asking? Do the conclusions are actually supported by their own results or not? Because what usually I was teaching undergrad and graduate courses, and I would give the same papers, actual research papers, to everyone in the class and ask these questions. And how people would come out with, they would say there is their results do not support any of their conclusions in the paper, where the other half of the class would be like, no, they totally support their conclusions. So it's not a clear cut. You know, it's really a lot of nuance, and it depends how do you understand the numbers or whatever they are measuring or talking about. And it's things are always more complex. It's very hard to find like clear cuts. It's all kind of gray, and it's a lot of space for interpretation of the results. So I would just say, like, in general, you're interested in something, read everything you can about that. And usually if it's a hot topic, you're going to have all views, different views, usually two very opposite views on exactly the same problem. So that is telling you that it's not so clear what's happening here. And I myself find all the time in this being one side of one question. But I myself try to tell everyone, read what I wrote, but also please write, I read this other stuff from these other people, which say absolutely the opposite. And then you can come up with your own conclusions. But most people don't do that. But that's my advice.
No, that's great advice. Like, take it all in. I think we don't do enough of that in life and society and anywhere anymore. Sergio, thank you so very much. I know you've got to run and I'm watching the clock as we do this, but thank you for sharing this time and your day. We are going to definitely get together and do this again and talk about some of the work you do. And as I mentioned, maybe I can get back to New York and we'll do this in your office with all of your bones scattered around the place and we'll bring a video camera great. To do it. So
that would be great, Jerry. Thanks so much for inviting me.
I really appreciate this. Thanks so much. Have a great day. Cheers. I want to thank Sergio for sharing part of his day with us and also for creating the book Humans. It's a really fascinating read. You'll find a blog with a link to Sergio's book on our website at talkingapes.org. You've been listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Our conversations are with folks from across this planet of apes. Writers, researchers, conservationists, and scientists, all getting us closer to understanding who we are and why. I would like to thank our entire Talking Apes team, especially assistant producer Damel Zaban, for all the work they do on bringing this podcast to you. And I would like to thank you, the donors and Patreon members who make Talking Apes successful through your generous support and the sharing of this podcast. If you appreciate what you hear on Talking Apes, consider supporting us. Please visit our website at talkingapes.org. Finally, I would like to thank all of the dedicated folks on the front line of great ape survival. We hope through Talking Apes, we're able to shine a light on the incredible selfless work you do every day to ensure great apes, primates, and their forest homes survive and thrive into the future. I'm Jerry Ellis. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing with family and friends the Talking Apes podcast.